Welcome to the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Podcast. I'm Kate Moore Youssef, and I'm a wellbeing and lifestyle coach, EFT practitioner, mum to four kids, and passionate about helping more women to understand and accept their amazing ADHD brains. After speaking to many women just like me, and probably you, I know there is a need for more health and lifestyle support for women newly diagnosed with ADHD. In these conversations, you'll learn from insightful guests, hear new findings, and discover powerful perspectives and lifestyle tools to enable you to live your most fulfilled, calm, and purposeful life wherever you are on your ADHD journey. Here's today's episode. Today, we are talking about hope. We're talking about fear. We're talking about adversity. We're talking about all our broken bits and embracing our failures and moving forwards, being more authentic. And I'm delighted to have Gail Muller here. Now, Gail is a Cornish adventurer. She's an author, speaker, and coach. And she has spent 20 years in education, teaching, leading, and consulting globally, helping raise aspirations and encouraging lifelong learning for all. She is also a passionate advocate for the belief that our broken bits are actually our superpowers. And she was recently diagnosed with ADHD a couple of years ago. And she's also struggled for 15 years with debilitating chronic pain. And we're going to talk about this a bit more. But in 2019, after considerable physical rehabilitation, she walked the Appalachian Trail in the USA and later writing a best-selling book about the experience called Unlost. I'm absolutely delighted to have you here, Gail. I could carry on reading this bio, but what I'd love to be able to do is talk to you. You've got a new book out called Do Hope. I've got it here on my desk. I've done a very ADHD thing and like just folded over loads of pages, underlined random bits, and just hoping that I can sort of pull it all into our conversation and really kind of give the listeners a full spectrum of who you are and how you help and what you embody. So welcome to the podcast.
Gosh, what a wonderful introduction. And thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I am very grateful to be here and to share some of my story with your brilliant listeners.
Well, you know, listen, I'm absolutely delighted because it seems like you do a lot. I'm just reading again, you know, you run online courses, residential retreats, you give talks all over the world, you help people with their writing. But essentially, you know, what I got from your book, which is called Do Hope, Why You Should Never Give Up, is you want to empower people who feel lost, broken, hopeless, who maybe have focused so much on their broken bits, like you say, and that negative voice. And I really feel that the neurodivergent community can relate so much to that, that we hone in on our failures and all the things that we can't do and all the things that we struggle with. And we forget to see all the things that we can do and lean into those things where we can sort of change those neural pathways and really live in hope. And, you know, for me at the moment, with the world so messy and dark and just feel a bit hopeless, and that is the word that keeps coming to me, you know, this past sort of 5 or 6 weeks, is hope. It's like a proactive word of like, what else have we got? And so I wondered, you know, I guess, you know, this is your second book. Why did you feel such a deep call to write about hope?
Well, wow, there was such a lot in there, and you've nailed some really important things. So first to say that with my ADHD diagnosis about 2 years ago, that was an incredibly pivotal moment for me. But with or without an actual clinical diagnosis, lots of us feel a bit othered from the way the world rushes forwards, sometimes without us, sometimes with us, keeping up but tripping over our feet, if you like, metaphorically, just trying to get ourselves together to show up in the world in the way everybody else is seeming to. So the diagnosis is helpful in helping you realize, well, it's not my fault. And for me, hope was something that has helped take me through hugely difficult periods of my life. I am very resilient and I'm pretty adept at seeing positives and opportunities as well as the difficult obstacles. But I've had some very challenging moments in my life to do with chronic pain, my invisible illness, a prognosis of not being able to walk for the rest of my life, all sorts of other traumas and tragedies where hope seemed to be the only thing left in the basket of resilient tools that I had. And rather than give up, I always tried to figure that another minute, another hour, another day, things can change. The idea that anything can happen, if you're open to things improving, often things can improve. But what I'd like to move away from is hope is this esoteric, whimsical, oh, wishful thinking, which is a bit woolly and wishy-washy. Hope is actually a pretty concrete, if you look, this the science of hope around hope molecules, which itself is a little bit, you know, in it's emerging science. It's not there's not a lot of data and research, but I think that hope is something that you can use as a strategy that can have concrete outcomes and is not just whimsical wishful thinking. And I myself, after my diagnosis 2 years ago, needed again to really lean on hope and the hope that I can get through, the hope that people can be more patient with me as I explore this difference in how I operate in the world. And the hope now that all of us can find the strength and courage to look at the world with fresh eyes every day when we get up and not feel like it's hopeless, that we should just give up, that what's the point, every day there's more bad news. Hope kind of gives you the space to examine where you are, to think about where you'd like to go, and to give you breath room, breathing space, to build a little bridge between the two. So hope is like a holding place as well as a concrete series of outcomes. Sometimes we need to give ourselves that respite, and hope is a good place to sit and find that respite.
Yeah, thank you. You know, when you talk like that, it reminds me a lot of the work of, you know, Dr. Joe Dispenza, who spends a lot of time with the more of the sort of the science behind when we use our energy to project into the future and see ourselves doing the things differently, and how we can almost change our reality by changing the way we think and we change our actions. And I believe that hope potentially is that we're envisaging a new reality, new beginnings, new ways of doing things. And you talk about chronic pain and feeling like you were potentially going to be in a wheelchair. And I just wondered, maybe you can give us a little bit of a backstory with regards to that and how that showed up in your life and how you coped with it and how you are now, and the fact that you went and did this incredible trek, which, you know, for someone with chronic pain must have been incredibly difficult, and there must have been a huge amount of resilience needed to get there. So would you be able to tell us a little bit about your chronic pain journey and I guess how you've moved from there to being in a place of more hope?
I was born with my feet turning in the womb. They were curled up, and then I've spent the first 18 months of my life wearing casts on half casted in my feet so that they could straighten out as I grew. I don't remember any of that, but I have the cast still, and I'm told about it by mum, and there's photos of mum and dad. So that's great. You know, they saw there was an issue and they helped to fix it. However, my feet still turn in a bit. I'm a bit pigeon-toed. And in my teens, my uncle sent me to a clinic in London. So he was worried about my gait. Mum agreed that we should have it looked at. So did dad. So we had a look. And in that appointment in London, when I was about 13 years old, I would think, there was the prognosis. I didn't let my mum come in the room. We left out at home in Cornwall, and the guy had said to me after watching me walk on the machine and analysing it that if I didn't have my feet broken and reset, it was very likely I'd be in a wheelchair at 40 and I'd be in horrendous chronic pain for a lot of my lifetime. I don't know if that was a wise thing to a 13-year-old who was my early teens. I was wide-eyed and didn't really understand and didn't really want this to be the case, so I just said, oh, okay. And didn't tell mom, I just said it was all fine, thinking that something would come in the mail about it if it was very important. And because it was a one-off appointment, things didn't connect somewhere along the line, and there was never any follow-up, which I didn't. I thought, well, there must have been follow-up and it wasn't important enough to talk about, so woo, I'm fine. However, it floated around my head for many years that maybe my future was going to be bleak in some abstract sense that I didn't really have any understanding of. But I muddled on, happy as Larry, swimming and hiking, and I rowed for my local gig rowing team. A lot of exercise, a lot of outdoor stuff. And it wasn't until my mid-20s that I started to get really bad pain through the right-hand side of my body, through my right hip, through my right leg, and thought it was from doing teacher training when I was about 27, lots of leaning over desks and marking and looking at children's work and a lot of rowing, one-sided rowing for gigs in Cornwall. I thought I was making myself a problem. So I stopped lots of those different things, not teaching because that's my lifelong passion, but you know, the exercise, the worst things you can do actually are to stop exercise that are keeping you strong and your core together. And my pain progressed and got worse and worse and worse, and it bled into 15 years of chronic pain from an acute situation, which nobody had any answers for, and left me in very dire straits, very, very bad periods of depression, lots of isolation, the shame that comes with having been the most bubbly, gregarious, fun person, you know, with all of your friends. And then you're declining invitations and not showing up to things. And I struggled into work. I very rarely missed work. And then being given medication by the doctor because nobody had answers, opiates, which I'm grateful for because it allowed me to function, but gave me a lifelong opiate addiction, which is, you know, very much on its way out now, which I didn't realize I had till halfway through the Appalachian Trail. So 15 years of horrendous pain, investigating everything under the sun about what could have caused it. Obviously, I didn't know about ADHD, but I realized potentially looking at the biopsychosocial model of pain management, what's my environment like? What's my food intake like? What's my blue light? You know, am I sleeping correctly? Do I need cold water exposure? Do I need to work on breath? Anything, every modality under the sun. And ultimately, I was referred to the pain clinic by the doctor, who was a lovely doctor, and long live the NHS. I'm a huge advocate and lover of the NHS. But the pain clinic ended up being a place where I was told, you know, ultimately you need to give up hope. And that was the phrase that turned my life around, because I didn't believe that you needed to give up hope. He was an old school medic. He'd been there a very long time. And his advice was, well, stop trying to find a solution. Stop trying to think it will go back to how it was. You need to give up hope that you'll be back to a normal, and you need to accept where you are, and you need to get a disability badge application into your car. You need to consider that you'll need to give up your job. And I understand, especially with hindsight, what he was trying to tell me. I understand the benefit of acceptance, but the way it was presented to someone who has struggled for 15 years to keep going because they think there's something around the corner and let's all keep chipper, it was devastating. So I basically told him that I believe that hope and acceptance could exist hand in hand. You can accept where you are today and hope that tomorrow will be a better day, and that you can port that mindset with you forward through your life. Today might be shit, and you have to accept and own that and look right at it, directly at it, to accept it and acknowledge it. And then you scoop it up and you take it with you into the next day, and you hope that there'll be an answer. So that was an incredible journey, which was devastating and nearly took all of my energy from me. And then I went to do an incredible job in Europe, seconded by the government to the European Commission as a representative of excellence in British teaching. And it was out there on the shores of Lake Como, as I was considering taking my own life due to the fact that I could not escape this pain. You know, we're moving towards 17 years of endless up and down agony. And then I found the specialist who changed my life and diagnosed that it was something to do with my jaw, how my teeth met, my TMJ. And I had braces for 2 years, and the dentist and the chiropractor worked together in Italy. And it was a very hard road because you get worse before you get better. And as your mouth is moving, your teeth, the alignment changes, your whole body changes its alignment. And ultimately, it saved my life. I was able to get stronger and go out into the world and do epic adventures, which had been kind of denied me for so many years. And I think that for me, that was the epitome of, if you keep going, if you keep the little flame alive, if you keep trying, if you keep trying, if you keep thinking maybe, and looking for options, if you don't close yourself down, which is so easy when everybody's trying to tell you it could be this, it could be that, it could be this, and nothing helps, it's easy in the end to go, fuck it all, I'm not listening to another thing, because nobody who says they're a specialist knows what's wrong with me. If you keep that little flame alive somewhere, at some point down the line, there will be, if not a solution, a resolution or an answer that will help you get through. And that's where this understanding that what I've done is used a candle of hope all that way for myself, and I use it for my students and the people I work with and always have. And then I realized what a wonderful, wonderful energy. It's a belief system. It's a structure. It's a way of perceiving the world. It's not only a commodity, because it's shareable, it's ineffable, and it's regenerating the more you use it. Yeah. But I can use that to help more people going forward. And the more I learned, actually, the more I realized that ADHD is probably quite responsible for my heightened sensitivity to pain, also my high pain threshold, but, you know, my hypermobility, my how my joints flux out of position, inflammation in the body, heightened reactions to things emotionally leading to a higher inflaming of the body. So yeah, it all comes together in a package, and now I use that to jump forward into the world to help others.
Wow. I mean, that's the whole thing is incredibly powerful, but I just want to hone in on just what you were saying then is we have an episode from Dr. Jessica Eccles, where she's talked about chronic pain, hypermobility, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, chronic fatigue, so many unexplained conditions that neurodivergent people have suffered with and been dismissed from and invalidated. And she works, she sort of dedicated a whole career to this. And we talk about this in the episode because when we understand how neurodivergence plays into the mix of all of this, you know, how you talked about your jaw and your teeth, and she talks a lot about how we hold tension, inflammation in our body, our nervous systems are much more heightened. It's a huge amount to do with, I guess, the psycho-spiritual side of undiagnosed ADHD, of not understanding ourselves, not understanding what's going on in our brains, in our bodies, why we're reacting like that, why our sensitivities are the way they are. So there's so much unexplained answers that are sort of rattling around our body, which you mentioned about inflammation, that in a way obviously manifests with pain. And when we're not then getting the help and the support, and we're going to all these doctors and we're getting dismissed and we're told, like you know, we just have to accept that this is just the way it is. But that energy of hope, that is what we're able to hold on to and harness, and hopefully, like you say, find these resolutions. Were you conscious of the way that this hope for you was, you know, I go back to that word energy, it was changing the life force within you, and you weren't accepting from the doctors that this is just going to be the way your life is?
I definitely wouldn't have called it hope at the time. And I think that's why this book that I've written is so important for people to read, because once you know that it's a thing you can hang your hat on and it's a specific thing that anybody can create an agenda for themselves, then you're able to do more with it. For me, I am a particular type of character. I am ebullient. I am built to be naturally leaning towards positive and optimism. Not everybody's makeup is like that. So if you don't have a makeup that's like that, it's harder for you to be more open-minded and positive about what could come next. So you do need some more structural guidance, like this book is engineered to give people. So I think that I was belligerent of nature, that I knew that there must be an answer. It didn't make sense to my brain that if my body worked really well and now it doesn't, that there was no answer for that. I was determined to hunt down the answer. And if I ended up finding an answer that was, yes, biologically in your body, XYZ has changed, and that is irreversible because, you know, something's happened in your system or you have a degenerative condition, then I would have accepted that and gone, right, these are my new parameters that I will work within to build a big, beautiful life. But because nobody could give me an answer, I was determined to think if there's no definitive no, then that means there's an implicit kind of avenue for me to keep questioning and exploring about my health. So that's what I did. But when I look back with my eyes now, on the other side of a lot of it, I can see that that is a hopeful attitude, and hope can be harnessed in that way. But that risk of making it sound woolly and esoteric and then all your symptoms will dissolve is one that will make people shrug and then feel bad about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because people with ADHD, we have a fun time giving ourselves shit, don't we? So I think that if you tell people, well, now you've got your diagnosis, why aren't you feeling better? It's like, oh, something else to beat myself up about. Surely I should feel better now. I think there are loads of comorbid conditions. And I think that, yes, the heightened inflammation, the heightened sensitivity absolutely causes more problem. What's really useful and concrete are helping people who are neurodiverse accept their differences, understand that those differences make them feel othered and alienated in the world we might live in. But that's just because that world was constructed in a way pre-good understanding of slightly different brains. Their differences are their unique brilliances. And if they can view them differently and start to see how they can be used in the world for benefits and positives, then they can feel more confident about owning them and showing up with them proudly rather than hiding them away. And once you feel a little bit more empowered about yourself and who you are in the world, then that empowerment leads you to show up in a way that can take you forward, that can allow you to apply for jobs and be honest about the things you need. I need to wear noise cancelling headphones because I'm very sound sensitive. And if I can wear those in the office, I'm not being rude to my colleagues. I'm actually going to give you a better work output and my work is going to be even greater because this is something that I need, an adaptive need solution for me. If you're embarrassed or you don't understand yourself, you're not going to ask for those things because you're not owning them as things that help you do better work or show up better in the world. So it's a complex web of letting go of shame, understanding yourself, giving yourself time to see where you fit in the world, and then learning to stop fighting with yourself, which is the greatest battle of all. Why am I like this? Why have I forgotten my keys again? Why have I put that appointment on the wrong day in my diary when I thought I'd checked 7 times? And this happened to me 100 times in my life. And I'm over being so embarrassed about who I am. It's like I just go forward and then put something in my way to trip over every single time. If you calm yourself down, work on your breath, have a bit of space, go, well, if I mess that up, that's just part of me. And look at all this huge scroll of other things that I have that are absolutely golden that other people don't have because they don't have a brain like mine. So it's that switch. It's like the hopeful switch of attitude.
So on the podcast, you have probably heard me talking about our nervous system quite a lot. And I work with our nervous system in all my one-to-one sessions, but also all my group coaching as well. So I'm really happy to let you know that I have a 4-part workshop series called Regulating Your ADHD Nervous System, and it's all through the polyvagal lens. I recorded this a few months ago and it was a really successful coaching group. So I wanted to be able to make this available to you all as a 4-session series. You will get these once a week for 4 weeks, so it doesn't feel overwhelming and you're able to really sort of let the information integrate. So if you often feel out of control, you're easily triggered by daily stress, or perhaps you've noticed that your nervous system is always in this sort of constant state of fight or flight, this sympathetic mode, or perhaps you're just wondering how your ADHD impacts your nervous system and your daily life and would like to experience more inner calm, this is probably for you. So you'll have more clarity on what those triggers are of the feelings of anxiety and worry and the hypervigilance that impacts your mental and physical health. And you'll also gain effective daily practices designed to help you understand and regulate your own nervous system with informed and science-backed information. If this sounds like what you're looking for, head to my website. It's all there on the homepage. And really just have a read through and see if it's something that you need. So it's 1 month of dedicating to really understanding your own nervous system and what it is that you need more of to help you feel more regulated, calm, connected, and empowered. Head to my website, adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk. Let's get back to the episode. We talked a little bit before about you saying that before your diagnosis, you were really, you know, unraveling, and then the diagnosis came and then you sort of hit almost like a rock bottom. And I wondered if you'd be able to sort of talk a little bit about that, because I think it's a really important conversation to have because of the stigma behind, oh, I've got my diagnosis and everything's great. But actually, you know, I think what you insinuated that you actually went downhill after your diagnosis. Is that right?
Yeah, the sharp spike of up and then a sensational down. So after I became able to do lots more physical stuff, I hiked the Appalachian Trail, as I wrote about in Unlost, which is 2,200 miles from Maine down to Georgia, 14 states of the US. Humongous feat. Six, seven months, finished it with 2 broken bones in my foot. You know, it was wild. And then I did a number of different, I planned a lot of other hikes. I had them all locked in. I had my Pacific Crest Trail permit from Canada to Mexico, and then I was going to fly straight to New Zealand to hike the 2 islands of New Zealand, the length of the 2 islands. It was all booked, flights booked, all planned, bish, bash, bosh, people to meet along the way. And then COVID hit very quickly after I booked all of that. And I only had about 2 months after the Appalachian Trail finished in December and COVID started to raise its head. So it was very hard to go from lots of walking at 25 miles a day for 6 months through mountains to sitting down with a broken foot and being told not to go anywhere, even though I'd done 800 miles on a broken foot with a displaced fracture because, well, pain, and I'm used to that. I didn't realize it was broken.
Can I just ask, I'm just going to interject, because when you were craving this constant movement and constantly being out and the fresh air, being outdoors, was there any kind of like inkling then as like, why have I got so much excess energy? Like, why do I feel so restless? Why am I so aligned to this lifestyle? Was there any inkling there that there could be ADHD?
Not an inkling towards ADHD. I think I was living in London for the 2 years before that. I'd been in Hong Kong as director of academics the years before that. And, you know, and so it goes, all these amazing jobs all around the world. But the one in London, I realized my diary was full all the time and I was feeling unhappy. And the more unhappy I got, the more stuff I put in to see people. And suddenly I was at the gym at 6 a.m., then swimming, then going to tutor my student all day long. And then I'd be walking across to do something else in the evening, get back to my place at like 11 o'clock at night, barely sleeping. And I'm thinking, I want to stop, but I don't know how to stop. And none of this is making me happy. It's just draining my energy. And whatever I'm looking for, whatever peace I'm looking for, I need to stop listening to all of the other people that are telling me, you need to be more sociable, you're working too hard. So then I'm like, well, shit, I work hard because it gives me satisfaction and I'm really good at what I do. But then I'm not being sociable enough. Okay, fair enough. Maybe I'm not. And I'm not dating. Oh, God, right, maybe I should date as well. Get on the dating apps, get more friends in the diary. All that does is deplete my energy further. And I'm not showing up well to any of these things. And then people are like, well, maybe you need to, like, invest in yourself a bit more. You know, all this messaging that we think we should be doing.
Shoulds.
The shoulds. And the fact that actually you're just depleting yourself when you're trying to fill your cup. You're just like, there's a hole in your bucket, Liza, and it's all coming out and you've got nothing left. Mm. So I thought to myself, so I love train travel. I've traveled on trains all around the world and I've always loved it. I love slow travel. And I thought, what the hell can I do that keeps me moving forward? And now when you look at it, it's like, lol, of course that's ADHD. I need to keep moving forward because that feeling of progression, forward motion makes me feel phenomenal. But I can't do it with other people. I can't deal with any more noise, questions, chat. And I can't do it with any more cities, buildings, traffic. I was brought up in Cornwall by the sea. It's where I am now. I'm Cornish to my core. I don't need all this shit anymore. I need to have the courage to step off the treadmill of, I'm really good at my job, I'm very successful, top of my field with education and etc. What can I do that keeps me moving forward, but that puts me in nature and that gives me space and I don't have to have a diary? Bill Bryson's book, Walk in the Woods, I read years ago. Now I've got my body back. I'm going to go and do that. So there were lots of things in the perfect storm that took me to do that. And the walking every day, it didn't twig that I might have ADHD. It just gave me, I mean, it had its own problems, trauma, having been attacked at 18 or coming back again, being in the woods by myself, needing to be around people more because of the trauma of the assault. There was all sorts of things incumbent in that trek itself. But, and I think it's really interesting because my best field of working with young people has always been those young people, especially boys, who have neurodivergence, who are disaffected, who can't engage, who have difficulties understanding things beyond the literal, who, I bond on a professional level with those young people very fast and they trust me very quickly and I'm able to help them see themselves in a different light and to fly with confidence and strategies. I have never questioned why I was able to do that. I just always thought, I have got this funny gift that allows me to work with the most difficult students that no one else can have any success with, and not just make them better, because we don't make people better. We, as educators or coaches, we help other people see why they can be better, how they can be better, and give them the will and the confidence to try to be better for themselves. And off they go and do it, and then you step back and you let them fly. And that's the glory of it. So then, got back from the AT, my foot was broken, COVID destroyed all my options. I wrote the book because I needed to be moving. So I moved in my head on paper through a trail rather than in the real world. And as soon as I could, I booked a ticket for the hardest trail possible that I can think of at the time, which was the Continental Divide. Again, Canada down to Mexico, 3,200 miles, flew out very quickly. And I think COVID was a real precursor. All of my other functioning ways of dealing with ADHD had gone, which is why we're seeing a surge, I think, of people realizing they're different. I was on the trail. It wasn't like the Appalachian Trail. It wasn't giving me the same magic. It wasn't giving me the same thrills. The people I was with, I love very much. They're really good friends. I met up with them to start because it's dangerous to hike alone through Glacier National Park because of all the grizzly bears. Better to hike in groups so they don't attack so easily. And they wanted to go very fast, and it was like ticking off mileage, elite kind of hikers. I just wanted to enjoy being in the outdoors, but I couldn't slow down because the grizzly bears might eat me. So I had to keep up with their pace, even though it was not good for me. And that began this little spiral. And I was thinking, oh, I don't feel right. I don't feel quite myself. I'm not like I was before COVID. What's happened? So I decided to come off the CDT after a few weeks. And I'd done a chunk of 100 miles, but came off at maybe 300 or 400 miles. I can't remember how many miles. And then I decided, this was when ADHD was like, this is the peak of the, oh my God, dopamine hunt gone mad. I was like, right. I know loads of people all over the States from when I did the AT and had this big following on socials. I'll put it out there. Where shall I go? I'll come anywhere you want in the US and I'll come and hang out with you. And can, maybe you could show me around and I can... I'd had all these people going, come to Montana and come to this horse ranch, come to California, come to Alaska, come down here, we'll host you here, come and hang out here. Yeah. I just said yes to everything. And I found myself in the end, like spiraling around the west coast of the US. I got on a ferry that took 3 days to get to Alaska because you couldn't drive through Canada. I met some like hunters, people running from the police, hiding in Alaska. All sorts of crazy people. Ended up going to Denali and spinning around Alaska by myself for a while. And then I hired a car, flew back to Seattle, hired a car, drove all around down to California to the Redwoods with a... I ended up also on the back of a Harley Davidson with an ex-Marine I'd met on the CDT who was very nice and is a good friend, but it could have been dangerous. Hitching, getting in on a reservation with some... Native American Indian women who were very lovely, who were off to go to a casino. I was hitching with Gabe, who was my Marine friend. Dangerous potential things. And in the end, I obviously had just squeezed all of my dopamine receptors to their very zenith, trying to find this thing that I was looking for that the CDT hadn't given me. And I ended up in a tent, in a drought, in a field next to a dry borehole in the middle of nowhere in Oregon. And I absolutely lost my mind. I thought I was going mad. It was a huge crash of neurochemicals. And I posted on my socials how I was feeling. I felt desperate, afraid, away from home, out of control, devastated. I was so scattered in my thinking, I couldn't organize. Suddenly, I couldn't organize. How do I get out of this field? How do I drive that car? How do I book a flight home? I did not know how to function, which was so alien for the entirety of the rest of my life. I posted it on socials and somebody said first, oh, is it the perimenopause? And I thought, I mean, I'm only, what was I at the time? 42, 43, I hadn't even considered that. And I thought, well, maybe. But then people started messaging very kind, supportive messages of, yeah. It sounds like it might be ADHD. It sounds like it might be, it sounds like it might, again. And I was looking at them and I was honestly so blind. I was like, no, I work with students with ADHD. No, I work with autistic students all the, no, I would have noticed. I've noticed, it's my career, it's my job. No. And then I started looking at the adult women, you know, diagnostic criteria. And I was like, oh God, oh no. Oh my God. I think I've got ADHD and that's why I've lost my mind. That's how I've ended up burnt out in a hire car, knowing no one in the middle of Oregon in some random person's field who let me camp for no reason. Why am I here? What am I doing? So I managed to kind of gather my thoughts and think, well, if this is what it could be, then maybe, and it was like a resurgence of the chronic pain years, maybe there's an answer. And if there's an answer, maybe I can find it. But I'm going to have to go a lot more slowly than I did in the past because my brain doesn't work. And it was like I had maybe like a stroke or something. I had no brain function. I had depleted all of my dopamine completely. So I gradually, bit by bit, got myself to another coast, to the East Coast again, where I had friends who put me out for a few days. I did a little hike just to say that I'd done a bit of hiking and because I needed to, belligerent, you know. Flew home. Immediately phoned Psych UK and I did a lot of research on the plane and the airports, immediate, you know, hyper-focus research. Got an appointment, luckily, within a few weeks. And it was then I was like holding my shit together for the appointment. And after the meeting was over with the psychiatrist, she said at the end, I have absolutely no doubt that you have ADHD. And I am very glad and amazed in some ways that you are still here. I'm so glad that you still exist. from what you've told me, there are many moments where we could have lost you, and thank you for coming, and we can help you, and let's talk about all the avenues. And I tell you what, I was so elated, I nearly shot through the roof of my house with joy, because it was this vindication, this validation. I wasn't a fuck up. I have a different brain, and I have not been giving my brain what it needs to do all the shit I've wanted it to do. I suddenly, you know, all the shame, the years of why are you late, or did you forget, or but it's your mum's birthday, or why haven't you turned up to your niece's party, or never said with any callousness, but just that constant from all angles, oh God. And then that fear you have all the time, I've forgotten something. You live in that panic that I've forgotten something important. I'm sure I have. I don't know what it is.
I still have
all of that. Yeah, I mean, it still exists. But loads of that shame flushed out of me. And I was like, oh, yeah, baby, no, this is my fault. And then, of course, you know, well, it is my fault because it's my brain. So now I have to do something about it. But I've got people to help me. Yay. And then, so that was like, I don't know, a few weeks of real joy. And then there was a big crash. And it was, I did not see it coming. Firstly, the handoff between the diagnosis and having access, even privately. So I paid privately because I was able to at that time. I had a good income before I went on the hike, and I had savings I didn't use on the CDT because I came off early. So I used that to pay. And I thought, well, if you're going private, fine, it'll all get sorted and there won't be these big waiting lists. Got the appointment 3 weeks later. Bang, this is fine. Four and a half months after the diagnosis, before I even got to speak to anyone about meds or what the next step was. And in that 4 months, I was lost. I was like, but what am I supposed to do now? Because I still have the brain that's not working very well, and I'm still confused, and I'm still feeling really anxious, and I have to wait. And then imagine, I need to know what's happening next. It's part of my brain. But they can't, no one tells you when even you're going to get to speak to somebody. You just have to wait, and you don't even know when. So in that period of time, I had a huge crash. My relationship broke down. That was devastating. He's my neighbor. We're really good friends now. He lives through that wall, and I love him dearly, and he loves me dearly. But, you know, platonically, but it was a horrendous time. He has three wonderful kids that I'd been with, you know, been with him intensely through COVID, living there for 2 years, love the kids. So not being with them, but being here next door was very hard. And I also went through a lot of grief about who am I? Am I my ADHD, or am I this bubbly, fun, exciting person that's done loads of cool shit? Or was I only looking for dopamine? And if I'd have had a diagnosis when I was younger and had medication, would I have chosen better, less dangerous men? And would I have said yes to the nice guys who I found boring at the time because they weren't making my receptors go bing, 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 bing with dopamine? Maybe I would have had a family. Maybe I would have had children. Maybe I would have had that unit that's now missing from my life, which I don't mind. I'm okay with that. I didn't think I ever wanted children. But the fact that my brain chemistry that could have been picked up earlier could be responsible for me being single and child-free at 45, that for me was, you know, 45 now, 43 then, whatever. It was devastating. Who stole my other life? My brain stole my other life, and I didn't even know the reason why. So all of those things were really hard. Trying to tell people, friends who understood and friends who said they understood but didn't, and now see you with that slightly distant remove where they love you still, but you're someone they just don't quite understand how your brain works. So, don't know, should we invite Gail to that? Is that going to be weird for her sound sensitivity? I don't know. And other friends who are just like, of course you fucking are. I love you, whatever. I loved you if you just wanted to wear a turnip as a hat for the rest of your life. But still love you. Yeah. So yeah, it's pivotal, life-changing, good, but not all good.
Yeah. Wow. What a story. A few times in that story, like I literally, my throat's just like, you know, I've just felt like the urge to cry for you, because there was just, you're telling me a story and I can see me, but I can also see so many of my clients, so many people of the community that I work in you. And that is what I find so emotional, because there's just so many people like us. Who are just understanding themselves.
One more really significant thing which involves grief and joy is that my dad and I often clash. My dad, love. My dad loves me back. My dad and I clashed in my growing up and in my adulthood sometimes. We had a great relationship in my adult life. But we clash because he's a stoic male. Why are you so emotional about this? Or for God's sake, Gail, you know, in his moments when he would lose his rag with me. We are very different. And I think really he was in his own way on the spectrum in some way too, in his linear logical way. What a man. What an incredible man. My hero. And from my diagnosis in October, I had, we didn't know it at the time, 10 months with him before we lost him suddenly, shockingly and horrendously. But in that 10 months, and this makes me emotional, I was able to explain ADHD to my dad. And he did research and learned about it with me. And he said to me, I'm sorry, I hope you can forgive me that I didn't know and didn't understand sometimes when I gave you a hard time. And I said, Dad, you want to know because I didn't know. And he would say, I understand you differently. I get you. I'm so proud of you. Look what you've overcome. And it was like he'd gone back in the file of facts of his mind, looking at all of those times where he thought I was a pain in the ass and he didn't understand why I was being so difficult or causing a problem. And he went, oh. And it was like a cascade of forgiveness for both of us for our misunderstandings our whole lives. And I had those 10 months for my dad to see me as me and to know me as me and to... He would always forgive me everything anyway. But to know I never meant harm or never meant to be an irritant or a pain or to want clear, specific, dogged answers. But he's like, why have you always got to know the specifics, you know? So that was a gift and a gift. So if anybody is struggling with relationships with their loved ones, be they parents, grandparents, guardians, whoever it may be, and if that diagnosis can help you share with your loved ones why you might behave in a way they can't understand, it could release so much pain and create a whole new relationship. And for me, that was profound. I'm so grateful. So, so grateful.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Like, I'm literally crying here because it's, you know, what a beautiful story. And I'm so sorry about, you know, losing your father. And I think... Again, what this the diagnosis brings is a lot of generational healing and understanding and being able to look back. And I talk about this a lot on the podcast, is like looking back and understanding why certain family members had struggled, why there was dysfunction, addiction, breakups of marriages, relationships that just couldn't quite, there was an energy mismatch, because very often we do hear about potentially an autistic parent, what we'd now be able to see as, you know, autism. And an ADHD child, and very often there's a clash and an energy mismatch and an emotional mismatch. And it can be incredibly painful growing up in that, with feeling not understood by a parent. And you know, there's parts of that I really relate to. And it's really hard. And anyone listening, you know, right now, I think, you know, we just go through this healing process. And again, it's not this magic one that we, you know, we just have afterwards. We're just like, yes, I know what's going on now, and I just move on. There's so much healing and processing. And I think you telling your story and the vulnerability of it allows other people to kind of say, okay, you know, this is what happened to me. And it's not easy to process all the what ifs, all the things that could have been changed. You know, again, like you said, that file facts of education, choices, relationships, children, life, finances, addictions, like all these kind of sliding door moments that if we had more knowledge and more awareness, then we could have done things differently. But, you know, as we can't go back, but we can heal and we can move forwards, and we can do that with hope. And I would honestly say to anyone, read your book, because it's incredibly ADHD friendly. It's bite-sized. That's why I loved it. I've had it on my kitchen work table all week, and I've just kind of had a cup of tea and opened up a chapter at random and just kind of read a few bits. And it's like kind of like having like a little kind of sage in your ear. And I really, really have enjoyed just dipping in and out. And there's practical tips, there's mindset tips, there's your stories, and so many beautiful stories that we can use and almost kind of, you know, just tweak a few of the details, and there are stories. And that's what's really powerful about this community, that we see each other. There's this connection, this, and I know when neurodivergent people, you know, women especially, we meet up and there's just this connection that we feel, and it's almost like we're all trying to elevate each other and uplift each other and empower each other. And that's why I love, you know, doing this podcast, of speaking to people like you, And just before we finish, I wanted to kind of give to you, you know, when I hear your story and I hear about, you know, you talk about your brain a lot, but I just wanted to maybe just bring in the acknowledgement of your nervous system and how your nervous system, you know, was speaking to you when you were doing that trail that didn't feel right to you, and you were going faster and you were with people and it didn't feel right. And your nervous system was speaking a language that perhaps you were trying to sort of push down. And eventually you went into sort of what we'd say is sort of like a dorsal vagal state of almost like shutdown, where you were you just had nothing left to give. And with people with ADHD, I do a lot of work with nervous system regulation and the polyvagal theory. I'm in the process of doing a course with students discussing how the interconnection of ADHD and nervous system dysregulation, and understanding that through a polyvagal lens, and seeing that we potentially have lived in this sort of sympathetic state, which is very often that fight or flight, where we're sort of heightened, we're just going to the next thing and the next thing, not feeling settled and not feeling grounded. But then you were moving from that state that you probably felt quite comfortable in. You were probably quite used to operating from that state. And then it kind of, you went into the dorsal vagal, where it just felt like you say, you were in a tent or a rental car, and it's just like, that was it. You had nothing left to give. And that's kind of when people sort of, you know, say the words, I had a nervous breakdown, I had burnout. That's when I had to be hospitalized. That's when I had to go on intense medication, all those types of things. And so now, I guess, now you're back in Cornwall and you're in your environment where there's nature, you're feeling a bit more grounded. And I just wondered, now, how do you feel in yourself? Do you live in that place of feeling more regulated and grounded, but also acknowledging the fact that you do, like there is that dopamine seeking, and for you being, you know, progressing and being productive and using your mind and using your purpose, how do you balance that now that you have more kind of awareness?
That's a great question. And I think life just keeps lifing, doesn't it? So since I came back from the CDT, I probably have had the worst, most challenging 18 months of my life. The ADHD diagnosis and the I started on Elvance and did that for a while, but it was too strong for me. And now I take really tiny amounts of dexamphetamine twice a day, just so I can dip in, dip out and really regulate that. So not have that intense anxiousness that Elvance gave me. So that's been a boon. That's been really good having that to keep ticking me over. However, yeah, the diagnosis has been integral, and that understanding of my brain in keeping my head just above water throughout these 18 months, which without it, I think could have seen me post CDT coming back home after that trail, could have seen me spiral into complete nervous breakdown and maybe hospitalization and extreme depression. I can see how that pathway may have gone if I didn't have this top level now new understanding. I need to deal with myself in a different way through this traumatic landscape. I kept up with my psychotherapy that I have every week, and she's amazing, which I started when I came back from the CDT. Sometimes I miss them. I just ran an exceptionally beautifully brilliant writing retreat last week on the Helford River with 12 amazing women at different stages of their writing journey, from not writing at all to wanting to get their screenplay out or their novel out. Now, what's significant about that is not how wonderful the retreats are. My retreats are always thankfully wonderful because of the women that come. What was incredible about it was that I said to the women on Tuesday, so guys, normally I'd be around all the time and we stay in this beautiful country house, but at between 5 and 6 today, I'm going to disappear because I'm going to have therapy. And old Gail would maybe have counseled that so I can just be here, give for you all week long. And I've learned in the last year that if I can't hold space for myself and make sure I'm keeping myself steady and well, I can't hold space for you. So I'm going to disappear and have therapy and then I'll come back. And that's great. Is everybody okay with that? And everyone was like, yes, thank you for saying that. And I'm like, and I'm giving you permission in your lives to go back home and take some time to think about what you need and make sure you create that for yourselves. And they were like, yeah. So that is just a really small example of what I've learned since the diagnosis that have helped me navigate being at home. And long may that continue, giving ourselves space, grace and time.
Amazing. I think I'm just going to leave it there because that was a bit of a mic drop moment. I just want to thank you, Gail. And I really honestly resonate with so much that you said. It's just, I could listen to you for hours, but I would highly recommend the book, Do Hope. And I've just, if you've got a website that we can direct people to.
GailMuller.com, yeah. If you want to work with me, if you want to come onto the retreats, if you want to be involved, or come sign up to the Substack, Unfuck Your Life under Gail Muller, and we'll all unfuck it together.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Gail.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you.
I really hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did and it resonated with you, I would absolutely love it if you could share on your platforms or maybe leave a review and a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please do check out my website, adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk, for lots of free resources and paid for workshops. I'm uploading new things all the time and I would absolutely love to see you there. Take care and see you for the next episode.